Welcome to Radical Feminist Perspectives. Today we are going to hear about the book The Spinster and Her Enemies: Feminism and Sexuality, 1880 to 1930 by Sheila Jeffries, and it's being discussed by Elizabeth Miller and Sheila Jeffries. So, welcome both of you, and over to you.
Hi, everybody. I'm really happy to be here today. I'm very grateful to Sheila for agreeing to talk with me about her book. And this is really one of my favorite feminist books. In fact, I love it so much that I have oh, I don't know how I have a copy of the original and a copy of the re-release from Spinifex. So that's how much I like it. So I wanted to just say a few things at the beginning about why I like this book so much. And it's really because when I first read it, and now I've read it several times, and when I first read it, there were so many things in it that surprised me and really kind of knocked me for a loop and enlightened me that I found out in it that I did not know before. And so I have a quick list here of the things that so surprised me in this book that I learned from the book. So the first thing was that there was a massive feminist campaign for 50 years, from approximately 1880 to approximately 1930, that was basically unknown or ignored by mainstream historians then and up to the present day. This massive feminist campaign was against men's sexual abuse of children and minor girls. And they worked really hard to get legislation passed and get all sorts of other things done. And it just was unknown after it happened. And Sheila uncovered it, which is another story that we'll talk about. Another idea that I was unfamiliar with is this mainstream historical idea that the past 100 or 150 years has been a straight story of progress from Victorian prudery to sexual freedom for everyone, and that's actually a myth perpetuated by men and anti-feminist women, that in fact there was, as I said, this big campaign to stop men from abusing children and to free women from the necessity of marrying if they didn't want to. And then there was a huge backlash to that campaign. Another thing I found out that I didn't know was that there was a huge number of women who never married from about the mid-1800s to the 1920s, and that a great number of them chose not to marry and chose to become independent by entering higher education and the professions, and that men saw that happening and waged a sort of backlash propaganda campaign against it to try to pressure all women to marry and produce children. Along with that, there was a huge industry of sexology books and marriage manuals that sold all of this propaganda to women from about the 1920s until essentially now. The marriage manuals basically say very similar things even today. And that the propaganda campaign had a lot to do with causing the end of this big militant feminist movement that started around the 1880s and went for about 50 years. So I didn't know any of that. And I was just shocked to find this all out in the book. So shocked that I had to read the book more than once because it was just so eye-opening. And so with that, I want to engage in conversation with Sheila. And I have a series of questions for her. So Sheila, thank you again so much for discussing your wonderful book with me. And the first question is how you would describe sort of the overall point or thesis of The Spinster and Her Enemies.
Okay, well, I had an MA in this period of history, so and we'd covered the suffragettes, so I would have thought I knew a little bit about feminism. That was in the early 70s. And then in the late 70s, 1978, I got involved in the Rape Crisis Centre in Leeds, in Yorkshire. And one of the things I became really interested in was sexual abuse of children. And in fact, at that time, when we were sort of doing training of women who were coming onto the helpline and so on, I would train on how there were two victims in the case of sexual abuse of children, the mother and the child, and so on. So I was really interested. I wrote quite a bit about the terrible stuff that was said about child sexual abuse back then. Which was that women were responsible and so on, terrible stuff. So I was really interested in that. So I thought that's what I'm going to do a PhD on. I'm going to go and ask women what is their experience of child sexual abuse. I put a letter in the local paper. Women started writing to me about it. I mean, there was hardly anything on it. I mean, it wasn't written about at the time. There wasn't a feminist campaign. Nothing much was happening. But I really wanted to look at that. That's what I thought I was doing. And then, so my whole issue within feminism was violence against women and child sexual abuse. And then I decided I'd do this PhD. Then I went to the Fawcett Library in London to look at what they might have, because it was a feminist library. I thought something to do with my research, something to do with child sexual abuse. Now, contemporary, I had no idea that there had ever been any campaign about this before. That feminists had ever looked at it before, because in the early 70s, it wasn't happening within women's liberation movement. Feminists were not writing about it then. It wasn't until the late 70s that feminists in this new wave started looking at it. So the whole knowledge of the fact that there had ever been a campaign before had somehow extraordinarily disappeared. So the point of the book, really, once I discovered that, was to show that campaign that you were talking about, to show that feminists had done all this extraordinary work, and also that it had been disappeared, as feminism, the women's liberation movement, has pretty much been disappeared again, really. It works very well when patriarchy decides to disappear feminism because it's too threatening. They do disappear it with extraordinary efficiency. So I needed to. What I wanted to do was show there had been this massive campaign and then show the extraordinary backlash to it.
And that's really what struck me in the book. I'm sorry, there's a little echo. Am I okay now? Yeah, that's really what struck me in the book was both of those things. It was just so astounding because we don't think that much about massive political movements being disappeared from history, even though maybe it's naive of me to not really think about that, but I didn't. You did a lot of painstaking research in the Fawcett Library into multiple primary sources. And when I read the book, when we read the book, we see all of these quotes, like very detailed excerpts from these primary sources. And I think you said nobody had really read these before or paid attention to them. So talk a little bit, if you would, about what your research process was like. I imagine you going through boxes of letters and sort of reading handwriting. Very painstakingly reading handwriting. It must have been extremely difficult to sort of cull all of this information from these dusty, kind of unorganized primary sources. What was that like?
Well, there was this wonderful library, the Fawcett Library. The contents of it are now in LSE in London, and they've disappeared into other archives. But this was a wonderful archive and library of its own. It was set up to contain the archives of Millicent Fawcett, who was a very famous suffragist, who was born in 1897. So it collected, it got all her stuff together, and also lots of other women's archives since then, before I went there in the late 1970s. And what they had was full runs of these extraordinary newsletters. I mean, there were lots and lots of feminist newsletters which said all sorts of marvelous and wonderful things. And I remember that one of the newsletters, I think it was the WSPU newsletter, had something called A Comparison of Punishments, which was looking at the punishments that men would get for stealing a loaf of bread or sexually abusing a child, a 7-year-old child. and pointed out that it was much worse for stealing a loaf of bread. And in fact, even at that time, this was, in about 1910 or so, they were blaming the children and saying that the children led the men on and so on. I had no idea that there were these wonderful newsletters with all this fascinating information. And as far as I knew, I'd never seen anything, and I was a historian and of that period, that had looked at any of this stuff. So yes, there were letters, some wonderful stuff in letters. There were books, pamphlets, the records of organizations, their sort of minutes and all of the stuff that they'd collected. And such stuff I collected from the 1930s, which I didn't write about because I think it was slightly too late, was from an organization looking at the abuse of Aboriginal women and the rape of Aboriginal women in Northern Australia. And there was an organization dedicated to looking at that, which I was just astonished by. And of course, I then went to live in Australia. So there was amazing stuff. And how come feminists have not been interested in all of this? What happened was that there was the historian was called David, who had control of this wonderful library, and I would be sitting there and I'd go, "Oh," and he'd come rushing over and lean over me and I'd say, "Look at that, look at that." And he and I were both found it very exciting. I mean, he was very pleased I wrote the book because, it was using his wonderful library. He knew the stuff was there, although not the half of it, not the detail of it. So that was a really, really exciting. I mean, discovering this stuff, the process was just absolutely amazing.
Yeah, it sounds amazing. I mean, I've done some historical primary research myself, and it's very painstaking, but when you find new things, it is very exciting. So what did those primary sources show you that was different from, there's sort of this common wisdom about the social purity movement. So that is something that gets talked about sometimes, before your book even, and the common wisdom about the social purity movement is that it was all about these prudes who were anti-sex and didn't want anyone to have sex, and that's really all it was, and that we've become much more enlightened since then, and that's all anyone ever really says about the social purity movement was that it was basically about people wanting to stop other people from having sex. What did you find out that was different from this common wisdom about history that had been being pushed?
Yes. So when I did an MA in this period, and we did something about the suffragettes, we heard about the prudes and the Puritans and how, the feminists had been very unenlightened about sex. And I absorbed the conventional wisdom, which was, it was, a story of progress from backward
Right.
prudery, where they covered the legs of pianos because they could be too rude to see the piano legs, up to, incredible, exciting sex of the sexual revolution. So that was the story. But in fact, of course, there was this great campaign by women, and they had had particular objectives that they worked towards and actually won on, one of which was the raising of the age of consent in the Criminal Law Amendment Act to stop men using women in prostitution. That's basically what it was about, because men could just use little girls and say they consented and have no problem with that. So that was really important. And there was Punishment of Incest Act. There was no penalty for incest. Men and brothers could use their female relatives with impunity. The feminists set up a huge campaign around that. There was a campaign against rape in marriage, which was not really successful at that time. They didn't manage to change the legislation, certainly. So all of this was going on. I'd known nothing about it. And it was an attempt to change male sexuality, to curtail, restrict, change male sexuality in the interests of women. And there's this big recognition of the way that sex imprisoned and subordinated women, and they analyzed it, and there was philosophy, and that was extraordinary stuff.
Yeah, there was a lot in the book that was so interesting to me about the social purity movement, where women were trying to get men to change, actually. That was a big part of the campaign, was to try to get men to realize that another myth was that male sexuality was so natural and so sort of violent and uncontrollable that men literally could not control it. And so women just had to sort of accept that men couldn't control it and just give them what they demanded. And this campaign, there was a lot of campaigning around trying to get men to realize that they were capable of controlling themselves and that they should, and that men should change. And then, this was also interesting to me, there were actually a lot of male organizations for men and by men that sort of took that idea and did encourage men to be chaste or to control themselves. But then what was also interesting was those then sort of went into around World War I kind of in a nationalist direction and kind of a eugenicist direction, with men saying, you know, we should remain strong for the good of our nation and things like that. So
The
it
race, for
got
the
a little
race.
bit off the rails. Do you want to comment on that at all?
Yes, I mean, I was very surprised by social purity because I had accepted the idea that these were just backward prudes and Puritans. And then I started reading what they were writing, and it was much more complex than that. The main thing was to end prostitution. They were all convinced that prostitution was a horror for women, and that, of course, they tried to rescue women. They set up these rescue homes and trained them to be maids and servants. So there were some of the things they were doing were a little bit questionable, but they certainly thought that prostitution had to come to an end, which was very strong.
It actually reminds me quite a bit of the Nordic model today that at the time women were being prosecuted for soliciting men. Men were not being prosecuted, and part of the campaign was to reverse that, which is kind of similar to the Nordic model. So it's interesting to see these things come back around in history and how hard it is to make progress.
Yes, the
That's one of the
Contagious
things.
Diseases Acts was were these acts which allowed the police to simply take women in off the street and examine them. Absolutely nothing was done. Men were assumed to have carte blanche. They absolutely had to, use that, do their urges, exactly how it is now in that sense. But yes, the women did make a difference. You know, they got in the end. In a later book, I explain that in the 1940s, they actually got a League of Nations convention against the trade in women. So women were very influential in that very early period, feminists of the 20th century, in curtailing men's access to prostitution and seeing prostitution as a terrible harm to women. But then, of course, we got the sexual revolutions of the second half of the 20th century, and men were freed up for their sexual freedom all over again. That's what it was about.
So I want to, one of the things that surprised me about the book was that there were sort of chunks of chapters on things, on topics that at first seem possibly not connected, or I mean that's too strong to say not connected, but they seem to be about different topics, but actually they all are connected to each other. And I want to just sort of mention these topics and then ask you about kind of what is the connection and through line that led you to bring these all together into this book. So the sort of main chunks of topics I see, or topics that have chunks of chapters about them, are first of all what we've been talking about, feminist campaigns against sexual abuse of girls, such as trying to raise the age of consent, trying to make incest actually illegal, against sexual abuse of women as well, trying to repeal the Contagious Diseases Acts, which allowed these compulsory examinations of women suspected, not even known to act as prostitutes, but even just women suspected of acting as prostitutes because they were on the street at night. Second, the huge rise. So then there's this other topic, the huge rise in women over this time period choosing spinsterhood, choosing not to marry. For life, many of them entering higher education, entering paid professions. And then, related to that, women's romantic friendships and lesbianism, and women living together throughout their lives. And then third, the backlash against both of those things, those feminist campaigns and the huge rise in women choosing spinsterhood, the backlash in the form of pressuring women to either marry and engage in sexual intercourse or engage in free love, meaning unfettered sexual access for men if they had partners that were not married to them. And then also the rise of sexology, which disconnected women's rejection of marriage and rejection of heterosexuality from feminist aims and rebranded women's rejection of marriage as prudishness and frigidity. There's a whole chapter about the invention of the concept of frigidity as something that needed to be cured by sexology. And then also in the case of lesbianism, the invention of the idea of sexual deviance, that lesbianism was not something that women could choose to be together, but was a sexual deviance, a mental illness. That sort of also goes along with the rise in Freudianism and psychoanalysis and all that. So the first time I read the book, I felt like, okay, what do all these things have to do with each other? And I think I know now, but I'd like you to talk about what made you decide to write about all of these things in one book. What is the through line that connects all of these topics?
Okay. Well, first of all, I think what I need to do is just go back slightly and look at some of the ideas of the feminists in that period of the 1890s, for instance, so that we understand how the backlash developed and how all of those things developed in response. So, Joe, could I have the first slide? Next. Yes, thank you. Thank you. So, what I write about in the book is some wonderful women with shades of politics, and I try to explain what the shades of their politics were and how they differed from each other. This one, well, Elizabeth Wolstenholme, I am particularly fond of. She had a male partner, Ben Elmy, but she didn't marry him because she was a free thinker. She didn't believe in religion. She was involved in the Contagious Diseases Act campaign to end those acts. And the other women involved in the campaign thought she was embarrassing because she wouldn't marry and would actually give the campaign a bad look. And so they forced her to marry. And in the end, she had to marry Ben. But men also, Ben was very, very supportive and wrote similar stuff to herself. But she was extraordinary in the way that she made it clear that sexual oppression through sexuality was fundamental to the oppression of women. So I would just like to give you a couple of quotes from her to show how amazing that campaign was at the time. This is a little bit of poetry from her. She says, it's about marital rape, really. And marital rape was her main concern at this moment. For what a slave himself must, man must ever be, till she to shape her own career be free. Free from all uneasy touch of man, free mistress of her person's sacred plan, free human soul, the book that she shall bear, the truly free to breathe out air. From woman slave can come but menial race, the mother free confers her freedom and her grace. So, in other words, she's saying, yes, men will be liberated as soon as women can have control over their bodies. So control over their bodies is the absolutely crucial thing. And of course, we're nowhere near there. We are nowhere near there. Women are absolutely unable to say no. Women are in no position to prevent being sexually used by their partners and are under huge pressure to consent. And of course, there is still rape and so on. So the crucial line, I think, is number three, free from or uninvited touch of man. I mean, this is an ambition. It's almost impossible to imagine, almost impossible to imagine. And that was the ambition of these wonderful feminists in the 1890s. I mean, it is really quite horrifying to imagine how, 120 years later, we cannot imagine this. Impossible to imagine. Okay, can we have the next slide, Joan? Right, so this is her writing about marital rape. And she says, is a violation of the primary natural right is and ought to be wholly independent of any legal or otherwise artificially created relationship between the parties, and that would be a gross immorality that any act by a husband, however base and cruel it may be, is justified by the matrimonial consent of the wife, once given and never to be retracted. Well, this is extraordinarily modern. There was
And this was
no,
written in like the 1880s or so, right?
yeah, 1890s maybe. Yes. Whereas in Britain, marital rape only became illegal in 1992 as a result of case law. I mean, extraordinary stuff. And still, women actually have to be sexually penetrated. All over the world, women have extremely little right whatsoever to say no. It's absolutely fundamental to the oppression of women. And she wrote about it in a way which was, again, visionary, I think, really. Okay, Joe, so finish with those now. So.
Can I just point out a comment quickly that Marion just made in the chat that I think really fits in here? She says, in the early second wave, we used to talk about women abandoning men emotionally and sexually and just living life. The things that we fought for women, equal pay, domestic violence refuges, better job opportunities, et cetera, were all to facilitate women being able to abandon and walk away from men. And I think the men definitely knew that both in the 1970s and, 100 years earlier. And that was, I think, why I think that's part of what led to the rise of sexology and these marriage manuals.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Because at the end of the 19th century, with this huge feminist movement, women were actually beginning to gain forms of employment which meant they didn't have to marry, and they could actually go and live with other women and work as teachers or as typewriters, as they were called. Women who typed were called typewriters. So yeah, it was a huge threat. There was the possibility of women's independence, and that's one of the things that I'd like to emphasize is that the movement against them was because these women were actually gaining po the possibility of leaving men. And that's one of the reasons why there were so many spinsters and women were in a position to choose to be spinsters. It wasn't just that the First World War killed off their boyfriends. Women were in a position to choose to do something they'd never been in a position to do before. They'd always previously been dependent on their families, their father, a man they married, and so on. But they were able to choose to actually live with other women, and so on.
Yeah, actually, may I just point out one statistic in relation to that? So I got this from Chapter 5, Spinsterhood and Celibacy. So this is a statistic from the 1850s to World War I, the percentage of women in the population as compared to men rose greatly. There was more access to education and jobs for women, and there were more and more women making the political decision not to marry. And this really stood out for me when I first read it. In the late Victorian period, one in four women would never marry. And a lot of that was chosen.
Yep, absolutely right. And it created great alarm amongst men, amongst the sexologists, amongst the commentators at the time. It created huge alarm. So, Joe, can we go on to the next slide? Oh, sorry, this is a bit that I should have just shown you before. It's another example of what feminists at the time were saying. This is Frances Swiney. She was a theosophist. The theosophists didn't do sex, it was creative theosophy by Madame Blavatsky. Women married to men didn't. She was married to a general. I think she didn't do penetrative sex or anything of that kind. It was very sort of psychic. And she actually says, the first male cell, the first male organism as an entity separated from the mother, was an initial failure on the part of the maternal organism to reproduce its like, and was due to a chemical deficiency in the metabolism or physique of the mother. So men were just a terrible mistake that happened as a result of chemical deficiency. Otherwise, they wouldn't be there. She also wrote lots of interesting stuff about how the first organism that floated around in the ocean before any creatures were really formed, just reproduced without any need for the male organ. And then later on, there was an something that an organ that a creature that floated around that carried the male organ in a little sack around its waist. I quite like that one. And then it was quite a long time before there were free floating penises, which required some kind of alimentary canal and food to survive. So the penis that was floating around had to develop something around itself, which became a male life form. But all she thought, just a terrible mistake, just a kind of mistake in science. So, okay, can we have the next slide? Okay. So, as a result of there being this preponderance of women who were spinsters and the fact that so many women were choosing not to marry, there was a big campaign against them. And it was mainly by the male sexologists and commentators of the time. But the campaign for spinsters against spinsters was able to recruit some women. This woman, her writing in the 1920s, was Stella Brown. She was a socialist feminist. Now, what was interesting to me is that in 1977, the Pluto Press, which was sort of a left-wing press in London, published a whole book about Stella Brown, saying how marvelous she was as a sex reformer, as a socialist feminist, the very model of who feminists should be. Right? I didn't agree with that because I read her work and was horrified. So let's look at Stella Brown. She's talking here about spinsters. Careful observation and many confidences from members of my own sex convinced me that our maintenance of outworn traditions is manufacturing habitual autoerotists, autoerotists and masturbators, the language is lovely, and perverts out of women who would instinctively prefer the love of a man, who would bring them sympathy and comprehension as well as desire. I repudiate all wish to depreciate or slight the love life of the real homosexual, but it cannot be advisable to force the growth of that habit in heterosexual people. So Stella Brown was trying to stamp out spinsterhood and lesbianism because these were very, very dangerous. You see why I was unable to accept that there was a positive sexual revolution in the 1920s and that this socialist feminist was actually, somebody positive in any way, because what she actually wrote was horrifying. But the socialists who republished her work in 1977 obviously did not recognize this as a problem. And they didn't mention it, of course, in their book. Can I have the next slide, Joe? This is more from Stella. I would even say that after 25, the woman who has neither husband nor lover and is not undervitalized and sexually deficient, there was a lot of sexual deficiency around, apparently feminists tended to be sexually deficient, is suffering mentally and bodily, often without knowing why she suffers, nervous, irritated, anemic, always tired or ruthlessly fussing over trifles. Is that you? Are there spinsters here who have got this problem? Or else she has other consolations, which would be masturbation. She was very frightened, and lots of others were very, very frightened of consolations, which make her so-called chastity a pernicious sham, right? So it's extraordinary stuff. But this is the woman who was promoted by socialist feminist historians as, the most significant and important woman of her time, the revolutionary who was freeing women. And yet this is how she wrote. Extraordinary stuff. Anyway, I will leave that there for the moment.
Yeah, it is extraordinary stuff. And there were a number of quotes in the book by both male sexologists and women who agreed with them, talking about how women actually needed sort of an infusion of semen. It was almost like a medical treatment in order to be healthy, and that women who didn't get regular infusions of semen were all dried up and sickly. I mean, there was really a very developed theory around that, which was pretty horrifying and shocking to me to read. So maybe this is a good time to talk a little bit about what led to the creation of sexology, which started sort of in the 1890s and then continued into got really sort of very well developed in the 1920s. What I'm sure most people have heard about Havelock Ellis, who is celebrated even today as sort of one of the champions of sexual liberation, and he's posited as a feminist because he said that women were entitled to sexual pleasure. But in the book, we see kind of the dark side of that, that he was saying that he wrote all these sexology books saying that women should be having sex with men, and that they should be having it in a way that where the man was dominant and the woman was submissive, and that this was very important because it was both, there's a little bit of an inherent contradiction here. It's both natural to the way men and women are, but also it's extremely important that sex happen that way to sort of perpetuate the proper relationships between men and women in the world. But that we should make sure that women have orgasms during this dominant and submissive sex, because it will essentially because it will make them dependent on men. And also, I think it was seen as sort of a consolation for them submitting. So that was all very interesting to me. Do you want to talk a little bit about not just Havelock Ellis, but the creation of sexology as sort of a quasi-medical and quasi-scientific phenomenon? And most importantly, like why did this happen? What was it attempting to achieve in society?
Yes. Now, sexology arose in the late 19th century. There was the science of everything was being developed in the 19th century. There were men who were studying fruit flies and different for and the DNA of fruit flies, as it were, not DNA because they wouldn't have known that, but they were working out different names for the fruit flies, different names for everything. So these
I'm just going to
tools.
interrupt you for one second, Sheila, just because I think it would be so interesting to see somebody compare the work of Havelock Ellis and other sexologists to the work of the Freudians, which was also arising at the same time and has some of the same themes about sex, honestly.
And they knew each other and they wrote to each other. So they were definitely involved. There's no separation there, just slightly different angles and different emphases. So in the late 19th century, some men, generally medical men, decided they'd look at sex. And they do the same thing for sex as they had done for fruit flies and flowers and plants and so on. They would create, they would label different categories, they'd give them, Latin names so that they could follow them along, like capillary kleptomania was hair stealing, men cutting off women's plaits and hair stealing and so on. I think they've got a bit of Greek and Latin in there, but they were always using Greek and Latin to describe forms of sexual practice that they thought should not happen, and then the forms of sexual practice they thought should happen. So they took over from the church in actually regulating sexuality and saying how it should take place. And in the very early books of that kind, the descriptions of sexual practice were in Latin because it was considered they would be too rude for ordinary people to read. It was only doctors who were supposed to read it. So they were in Latin. Now, was the development of sexology inevitably connected with the rise of feminism? I'm not entirely sure about that, but what I am sure about is there was a massive feminist movement at the time, and therefore these men set about trying to work out how to control it and how to undermine it, and put women back in their place, really. So that was of huge importance to them, and sexual practice, of course, should take place in the form of male dominance and female submission and so on. And the once you start reading the stuff, it's quite extraordinary. For instance, Havelock Ellis, who was a medical doctor, he wrote that he knew that orgasm was like was experienced by women as pain. How did he know that? because somewhere in Italy, he was looking at one of his medical colleagues cut off the clitoris of a woman, and she made an expression as if she was having an orgasm at the time. So he knew that orgasm was the same thing as pain. You might ask, why was somebody cutting off the clitoris of this woman? Well, they did that in order to stop masturbation, or because they thought there were other problems with women that would be solved by that. One of Freud's friends, for instance, believed that there was a special bone in the nose that had to be removed if women were to be relieved of, I think it was painful periods or something of that kind. And in one operation, this man left a huge bit of gauze in the woman's nose, and that created a bit of a crisis. So he called Freud, who had to rush in and try and work out what to do. And I think they managed to get the piece of gauze out of the poor woman's nose. But anyway, they were just experimenting. So these men were not just writing the book, they were doing extraordinary physical experiments and surgery on women. So, yes, these men got very involved in trying to curb women's liberation. And they invented, I'll just say a little bit about the frigid woman stuff here. They believed that women who were frigid, not having orgasms with men, and of course, women didn't see any reason why they should. In the 19th century, nobody was talking about orgasms. Women were just being sexually used and resenting it, and so on and so on. But suddenly, at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, they're supposed to have orgasms. These men believed if they didn't, they and spinsters, and of course lesbians, would be what they called a, and this is the exact words, threat to civilization. Women could only be calmed down and subordinated if they had orgasms during penis and vagina sex. That's what they had to have, and they had to enjoy it because that would subordinate them. So you can see why they were very, very excited to create this movement of what they call sort of, women's sexual liberation. Actually, they called it in the 60s as well. It's always about women's sexual liberation. What it actually means is man's right to use women and control women. So that's what sexual revolutions are. But I think there's a lot of people who don't completely understand that.
Well, that leads to a question that I was going to ask about sort of thinking about the arc of feminist campaigns and then the backlash against feminist campaigns that we see in the book happening from this 50-year period from about 1880 to 1930. What parallels or differences do you see between that arc of feminist campaigning and backlash and recent times, the present day, like the last few decades, and today?
Well, I would say that the so-called sexual revolutions of the 1920s and the sexual revolution of the 1960s worked. The purpose of them, to a large extent, was to control women. And I think that worked in the 1960s. I mean, I've written about that in my book, Anticlimax. And the stuff that was being said was just as terrible as what was being said in this sexual revolution of the 1920s. In fact, dreadful stuff about controlling women and really very woman-hating. So I think it worked because at the beginning of the women's liberation movement in the late 60s, early 70s, I think a lot of feminists did think that one of the most important things about feminism was sexual liberation. They wanted orgasms. It's very, very difficult for women to have orgasms in penetrative sex with men. I mean, it's always been difficult. It is very, very difficult. Of course, in the 1950s and 60s, they said, as I explained in Anticlimax, women mustn't move about to try and get orgasms. They had to do exactly what they were told, penis and vagina sex, and suck it up. But at the same time, they were supposed to have orgasms. So that was very difficult. But I think at the late 60s, early 70s, there's a huge concentration amongst women who call themselves feminine on how women should be able to have orgasms, how they should be able to have free sexuality and free love, very much similar to what was going on in the 20s, in fact, without any understanding that sexuality needed to be fundamentally changed, that it was actually constructed through male dominance and a fundamental element in the oppression of women. So I think that was a problem in the early women's liberation movement. And of course, lots of other women, of course, were starting to work on violence against women in the same way and working out that things need to be changed and the male sexuality needed to be changed. So I think that the problem at the moment is that the same dynamic applies as was happening in the 1920s, which is we are lots of feminists are trying to change marital rape, rape in general, sexual abuse of children. But at the same time, we are faced with the sex experts. And the sex experts are the sexologists. They have all the authority of science. They are absolutely loved by the academy. They are respected. And they say all these dreadful things about what women have to do. There are lots of sex experts who are just sex therapists. There's a massive industry of sex therapy, all very, very hostile to women, pretty much, so far as I can gather, so far as I can see, extremely hostile and just serving up all these sexological ideas. And these days, of course, prostituted women, women who've been used in pornography, are used as sex experts in order to teach women what they must do to please men. That's still happening in exactly the same way, except they didn't use prostituted women in previous times. There's the whole of the pornography industry, which is the main form of sex education. So we are trying to change male sexuality, trying to end male violence against women, and faced with these massive forces, hugely more powerful than us, industries, science, universities. And of course, we get extremely little heard. So I think we are facing the same forces. We're facing the same problems. And yes, that's really what's going on. It's a huge struggle, absolutely huge struggle, and the sides are completely unequal.
Yeah, well, I have many thoughts in response to everything you've said, and honestly, I would love to be able to do an entire course on this book because it's so rich. Every chapter could be several weeks of discussion, but I know that we only have about 10 minutes left, and we wanted to talk about a couple of the individual chapters. I know you wanted to talk about chapter 6 on women's friendships and lesbianism, close romantic friendships. This was something else that was very, I didn't know. Close romantic friendships were seen as very normal between women throughout most of the 19th century. But then the sexologists created this so-called scientific theory of lesbianism and basically classified all close relationships between women, whether sexual or not, as being either lesbian or pseudo-lesbian, meaning sort of groomed into lesbianism, and therefore as mental illness that needed to be rooted out by encouraging women to engage in marriage or free love with men. And as I said before, this theory included the idea that regular infusions of semen were necessary to women's health. So I thought that was absolutely fascinating, the way that the sexologists were engaged in a project to sort of very heavily groom women against being in close friendships with each other.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And if you read the sort of women's novels, I mean, that's very fascinating to me that at the end of the 19th century, before close friendships and indeed lesbianism were prescribed as they were later, you've got really close friendships in schoolgirl books, for instance, and they're absolutely celebrated, these close friendships. And then in the 1920s, we see a huge backlash. And in those books, even the same writers, about probably the same women, the headmistresses, who were often lesbians living with each other, of course, you see a campaign against those friendships, and they're said to be dangerous and so on. So that's just one part. But there was a huge backlash going on against lesbians at that time, in the so-called sexual revolution. Can we have another slide, Joe? And this is part of the campaign. This is Mari Stopes writing in her book Enduring Passion in 1928. She was supposedly progressive as well. She was a birth controller. As indeed Stella Brown was, all the socialist, feminist, so-called sex reformers were birth controllers. I should say something about this at the time, this time, of course, which is that many feminists in the early 20th century were not happy about the development of birth control, because they said being able to say to men, no, they didn't want to have sex because they didn't want babies, was a power in their corner. It was something they found helpful. And what happened with the development of birth control was that men could use them at any time, day or night, whenever they wanted. And this was seen as not a good thing. So there was a battle there between the Mari Stopes and the Stella Browns, the birth controllers, and the feminists who said this isn't necessarily a good idea. I mean, it's something that has to happen if perhaps if women are in enslaved conditions, but it's not necessarily a good idea. So this is Mari Stopes, who was also a eugenicist, by the way, as many of these women were at the time. If a married woman does this unnatural thing, this is about lesbianism, she may find a growing disappointment in her husband, and he may lose all natural power to play his proper part. No woman who values the peace of her home and the love of her husband should yield to the wiles of the lesbian, whatever her temptation to do so. And as others have said to me, that Mari Stopes probably knows what the wiles of the lesbian are like and how exciting they are. And the way she writes about it, you get that feeling. So growing disappointment in the husband is because sex with women is so much more exciting and satisfying. Hands are so much better than penises in every way. So she's obviously fairly aware of that. And in fact, in Anticlimax, I talk about how one of the sexologists, an American sexologist in the 1960s, wrote that men should not use their fingers to pleasure their female partners because they'd never want the penis again. So it's a problem. It's a problem that being hammered with a blunt instrument is not necessarily something that women want to do. So yes, she was part of just a really quite vigorous anti-lesbian campaign at that time. Can we have the next slide, Joan? Now, I put this one up just because it's one of my very favourite slides. I've got quite a lot of information in that chapter on women's friendships and lesbianism about women who were lesbians at the time and what they were doing with each other, because a lot of women were. And one of them, one couple was Winifred Holtby, a novelist, and Vera Brittain, who you've probably heard of. Now, Vera Brittain married, and at that point, obviously, this took her away from Winifred Holtby, because that's what frequently happened. Women felt under enormous pressure to marry. There was a lot of social pressure to marry. Sometimes they couldn't survive without marrying financially. So Winifred Holtby, who then went to South Africa and died at about 36 of kidney problems, I'm very sad to say, she's writing to Vera Brittain after the marriage. And this, for me, is that it's the most poignant letter, and something that I can never get out of my mind. It's in my mind often. I am happy in a way, I suppose. I miss you, but that does not make me less happy. I find you in all small and lovely things, in the little fishes like flames in the green water, in the furred and stupid softness of bumblebees fat as laughter, in all the chiming radiance of warmth and light and scent in the summer garden. When a person that one loves is in the world, then to miss them is only a new flavour, a sort of sharpness in experience. It is when the beloved is unhappy or maimed or troubled that one misses with pain. But even pain is perhaps not wholly undesirable. So this is what happens to lesbians when women decide that they need to go straight and marry in that period. But you can see why I absolutely love the quote. Anyway, that's it for now. For that one.
Were you going to go on to another slide right now?
A bit more about, because I'd like to do my Eura Lagnier quote. Anything more you want to say about the sort of backlash in the 20s and sexology and so on?
Just one small thing that I was thinking about when you were reading that quote was that I just started doing a little bit of research into what was called smashing at women's colleges in the 1890s through like the 1920s, where women would have these very close romantic friendships or lesbian relationships. So it's not always clear which one. And it was seen as very normal and fine. And I mean, they were like full blown sort of, there was courting and there were flowers and poems and professing their love for each other. And this was all seen as very normal at women's colleges in the US. And then it wasn't. Then it was started to, the heads of the women's colleges started discouraging it and saying it was a terrible idea and it would prevent them from marriage. And they're actually, primary sources on this in, I believe it's the Smith College Archive, and I want to see if I can try to look them up because it seems really related to what you were just talking about. But I know we just have a few minutes and you wanted to talk a little bit about Chapter 7, Anti-Feminism and Sex Reform Before the First World War. And here, this chapter talks about the birth of sexology, Havelock Ellis, et cetera, in the period from the 1890s to the 1920s. And this development of sexology enabled anti-feminists to mount an onslaught on feminism with all the authority of so-called science, a science they invented out of whole cloth. Some of the ideas in sexology were that men and women have separate spheres. Women's sphere is motherhood. Women's liberation is to be able to engage fully in motherhood, and that women are naturally submissive in sex and men are naturally dominant. But also at the same time, it's very important that we need to organize everything to maintain that supposedly natural relationship between men being dominant and women being submissive. So it's natural, but it's also very fragile and it can be destroyed, and we have to maintain it very hard.
And indeed, Henry Havelock Ellis decided that he needed to say, because he was very confronted, obviously, by feminism, he needed to say that feminism should be a celebration of motherhood. That's what it should be. Not women thinking they can do all sorts of things that men do, the sort of jobs that men do, the
Not
sort of.
those pesky education and job things, not at all,
Yes,
just motherhood.
sports and sports. He didn't think women should do sports either. Of course, although the sort of movement of creating schools for girls was happening at this time, and women were doing sports. So, can we have the next quote? So, I thought we should have a poem from Henry Havelock Ellis. And this is him writing about urolagnia, which was his own personal interest, that is, love of urine. He used to get women to urinate so he could listen to them. He got one sex reformer to urinate walking into Harrods. He got another sex reformer to urinate in a room in his house so he could stand outside and listen. Anyway, this is his poem about urolagnia. My lady once leapt sudden from the bed, whereon she naked lay beneath my heart, beside my heart. And stood with perfect poise, straight legs apart, and then from clustered hair of brownish red, a wondrous fountain curve, all shyness fled. Arched like a rainbow, liquid rainbow in the air, she cares not she what other women care, but gazed as it fell and faltered and was shed. So, lovely poem. He was clearly into it. When I used to teach this, I did all the sort of movements and all of the arching liquid and so on and so on. So obviously he was interested in men urinating because women don't have this. Women don't do this. Okay. So he was into women, men liquidating, urinating, and he wanted women to do that to make him excited. But his wife was a lesbian. And he obviously found that a little bit difficult as well. No, as somebody's saying in the quote, was it a woman? Well, he in his eyes it wasn't. Yes, he did make women urinate for his satisfaction. So that's sexology, I think, in a nutshell, full of men with very, very, very strange, fetishistic, and peculiar ideas who wanted to justify all of them and also suppress women. But thank you. Thank you for letting me talk about all of this because I love these quotes. I just absolutely love them. And I've had an opportunity to talk about them.
Thank you so much for speaking with me about the book. I want to say that we've barely scratched the surface of this book. I really encourage everyone to read it. It's incredibly dense and rich. And I just want to I would love to talk about it for days. I just want to give Sheila the opportunity to sort of finish up and give us any closing thoughts for the moment about the book.
My only closing thoughts was I absolutely loved writing it. I love the quotations that are in it, and I'm very pleased that new women are finding the book and liking it. I mean, that's absolutely terrific.
It's a great book, and it, among other things, has made me think about many things that I'd like to know more about. And I think there's so many opportunities for further research that are suggested by some of the themes in this book. So I hope that women will consider trying to do some of their own primary research, taking off from some of the themes in the book and take some of that stuff further. So thank you again, Sheila. It's just, I feel privileged to get to talk to you about your book, because it's such an important book to me.
Okay.